This is Ozarks at Large. Tyson Foods is an American business success story. The Springdale-based company has revolutionized how the country buys and eats chicken. The company is the subject of a new book by Christopher Leonard titled The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Leonard covered Tyson Foods and other business interests in Northwest Arkansas while he was a reporter for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's Northwest Arkansas Bureau. Since he left that paper, he's had his work published in Fortune, Slate, and the New York Times. In his new book, he traces how the company grew from a family business, how some farmers are dissatisfied with their relationship, and how the business of poultry farming has changed over the past few decades. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently talked with Christopher Leonard about the book. He also asked Tyson Foods for a response, and we'll hear that response later on this edition of Ozarks at Large. During their conversation, Kyle asked Christopher Leonard what attracted him to devoting time to a book-length examination of the poultry business.
I had even written about Tyson a little bit before I came to Arkansas when I was a reporter up in Missouri back in the late 90s, and just, you know, walking into a chicken farm for the first time was an incredible experience for me and really memorable to be in one of these giant factory houses with 25,000 birds on the ground. I was just always fascinated with this system. And when I got down to Arkansas, it gave me a chance to report it even more. And it's just sort of the more I encountered it, the more I got interested in it. But I think what you could say really, really did launch this book was back in 2004 when I went down to cover the story in Waldron. There were reports in the morning news, actually, you'll recall, that there was a problem with the Tyson Foods hatchery down there, and these sick birds were being delivered to contract farmers. So it's just an interesting story, and I knew that the way the business was structured, some of the risk really was shifted down to the farmers. But I was deeply, deeply struck by what I saw down in Waldron and reporting down there. And really what struck me was just how much power Tyson had in that town. I was driving around to a lot of these chicken farmers, just interviewing them about what had happened and what was going on their farms, and it was remarkable to me. I mean, you know that farmers are pretty independent folks. They're up by their bootstraps kind of people, but there was this palpable atmosphere of fear around the company. I mean, people were afraid that their neighbors would find out I was on their property. I remember one guy I interviewed in his front yard who he was raising two kids. His farm was in trouble, and he just would slump his shoulders. He was scared to give me his name. He was scared to talk about what was happening, and I just thought, wow, there is something really important going on here. And that's, you know, really what launched the reporting for this book. I just wanted to learn more about how the system really worked and how it got to be the way it is today.
In the middle third of the book, you take us from the beginnings with the first John Tyson and through and how it developed. But you start the book with this with a family that lives in Scott County in Waldron, the Yandells, and you're with them in the process of their career as farmers ending.
Yeah. That was sort of ground zero for the whole thing. Jerry and Kenita Yandell, I went down there as the reporting trip I just talked about. I met with Kenita. Jerry was actually off trying to make some money working in California at that time. And it was such a sad story to me. I mean, this was a family who'd been working since they were little kids. I mean, Jerry Yandell is a guy who grew up working on as a migrant laborer in California on vegetable and fruit farms. He knew how to work, and they had gotten into chicken raising in their teens and had been in business for 20 years and had built a really decent middle-class life there in Waldron. They were big-time chicken farmers. They had several chicken houses. They were working 7 days a week, and they were literally wiped out and put out of business in 2004 because three consecutive flocks of terribly diseased birds were delivered to their farm. And again, it just struck me that here you've got this family that's really built a pretty solid middle-class life, and it was all wiped out in just a matter of months. I mean, that's all it took. That's how close these people were to the edge, and that's how vulnerable they were economically. And they are truly representative of modern-day poultry farmers. They're not an outlying case. And so, yeah, their story really shines a light on the economics of the business for the farmer.
So the profit margin is very shallow for the farmers who raise and sell the birds to Tyson, correct?
Correct.
Or any poultry giant, I imagine, for that matter.
Yes.
This is not just... You talk about what Tyson has built in a vertical integration. And I've heard that term before, but explain once again what vertical integration is.
Sure, you bet. The best way to understand it is picture a Tyson Foods plant in a little town where they're raising poultry. And by the way, we're talking big business here. Raising meat is still the economic pillar of a lot of these communities. It's the economic lifeblood. And so you'll have this giant Tyson Foods plant on the north end of town. And inside this facility, you will have what used to be independent businesses on Main Street. You'll have a giant feed mill, a hatchery, a enormous slaughterhouse, a trucking line. All these businesses have been sucked into a single silo of corporate control. They've been integrated. So Tyson Foods owns and operates all the inputs, all the components that used to supply and used to sort of support a rural economy of chicken production. And the system was invented back in the 40s in the South by Tyson Foods and other poultry companies that realized, of course, there could be great efficiencies to be achieved when they could sort of have this command and control approach to chicken production. They would make their own feed, they raised their own birds, they delivered the birds to a farm and picked them up. The farmer never owns the birds, and it allowed chicken to become produced in this incredibly efficient system that made chicken go from being sort of a specialty meat that was pretty expensive to being what it is today, which is the cheapest meat relative to other meats and America's most popular meat.
The story of how Tyson becomes this corporate giant is so compelling. Of course, it starts in the Depression when John Tyson comes south and doesn't have much to his name. He's traveling a lot. Sometimes his son Don has to stay with a neighbor or somebody else. You talk about an up from the bootstraps sort of story. That's where Tyson begins.
It is. It's truly, truly remarkable. I don't think we have people in America anymore that are like Don Tyson, that were born in that sort of environment of very limited means, a town that was certainly on the economic periphery of America at the time, right? Springdale, Arkansas, 1931. And Don Tyson, as you said, sort of lived at his father's feet in terms of business. I mean, at night they would sit around the family dinner table and talk business, and Don's stepmom would be keeping the company's books on a ledger. He grew up in this world. He understood the business. But what is truly, truly remarkable to me was that you could have a guy like Don Tyson who took over the company when his dad tragically passed away in 1967. And at that time, Don inherited what was just a regional poultry firm. There were lots like it. It wasn't a titan by any means. And over the decades, he, of course, helped turn it into the world's biggest meat company. It expanded. But what is really fascinating to me is that he had a mind that could perpetually adapt to growth on a huge level. I mean, to go from being a regional poultry guy in the 70s to being somebody who was welcome in the Oval Office when Bill Clinton was president, who rubbed shoulders with the biggest CEOs of corporate agribusiness, who was a billionaire, who ran a company with almost unprecedented reach in U.S. meat production. It's an incredible story, and he was certainly one of the most, I think, underappreciated business figures of modern American business.
One of my favorite stories that you write about is that for years, people, when he was president, chairman of the company, people might not know where he was. He was in Illinois courting McDonald's, trying to convince them to sell, put chicken on their menu. And this at a time long before the McNugget, when they sold hamburgers, but he saw fast food as a place to grow.
Yes, he was a visionary that way. I mean, back in the 60s, chicken just wasn't on the menu. A hamburger was kind of the perfect fast food meat. But what Don Tyson realized was that because of the vertical integration and the industrialization of the chicken business, they could make a pound of chicken more cheaply than either beef or pork. And he knew that those economic forces would make it all but inevitable that chicken would get on the menu. But back at that time, the whole concept of a chicken sandwich was just bizarre, let alone nobody had fathomed or seen the McNugget yet. And yes, he was relentless in going to McDonald's, rejection after rejection. He worked over 12 years telling them, you know, you need to do this. And then finally, some food scientists invented the McNugget, and Don Tyson was there at the exact right moment and right time to seize the opportunity, and he had this vertically integrated company behind him. So what he could do that was amazing was go to McDonald's and say, you give me your order, I will turn around and retrofit an entire farming system to fill that order. I can control the slaughterhouse, I can control the farms, I can control the genetics of the bird, and we will fulfill your order. So that's when they really exploded and took off, was with the sort of advent of the nugget and the tender.
You mentioned that the business press hasn't covered Tyson as much as they have other companies because it's not as sexy, it's not as interesting. It's from a Wall Street perspective, sometimes boring.
Yeah, and I really fault the business press for that. I would like to point out the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's not guilty of that. It's a great state newspaper. But having been a business reporter for a long time, there is a really unhealthy obsession with the daily churn of the stock market. That just seems to be the main story of all the business press. And I kind of liken it to the financial journalism equivalent of kitten videos on YouTube. It's easy, it's sexy, you get it, it's a quick story. Hey, Apple stock is up today because of rumors of a new iPhone. But when you're so obsessed with that daily stuff because it's easy to cover, you can really lose sight of some of the important systemic changes that are happening in our economy that really affect people, that really affect consumers who eat meat, for example, and farmers who raise it. And I think that there's a lack of interest and a lack of willingness to kind of dig deep into these institutional stories as opposed to covering the stock market churn. And yeah, for that reason, you know, Tyson Foods is a transformative company. It's a very powerful company in the United States, but they're not going to invent a new iPhone. So they're not going to move the stock market in a given day. And because of that, they really don't get the scrutiny that they warrant.
You talk to farmers, you talk to people who used to be farmers, but you also talk to people who used to work inside corporate headquarters. And I think you might have talked to some people who currently work, though they didn't want to be identified. What was the reporting like when you were talking to people who were deeper into the company?
I think I was really fortunate to interview a lot of people who helped build the company over decades, including Don Tyson, his close advisor and friend for many decades, Jim Blair, who's an attorney, clearly, easily one of the most intelligent, remarkable people I've ever met in my life. And I think that these people were proud, justifiably proud of what they'd built over decades. And I think they also felt Tyson Foods was an underappreciated story and a story that was misunderstood. And they were eager to talk about it. They were eager to share what they had done and share their story. Now, if I could, ask myself a question here, which is, well, gosh, what do they think of the book, you know?
Have you heard?
You know, I haven't heard directly from a lot of these folks, and I can't imagine that they're happy with a lot of my conclusions. But, you know, what was reported is the accurate and whole picture as I was best able to attain it. And I think that sometimes when you work at the center of a company or at the top, the thing is so big that you can miss what's happening at the bottom and on the fringes and some of the realities on the ground of the system that's been created. So, you know, I tried to represent the brilliance at the heart of Tyson Foods and the transformative nature of the company, but also what I think are some really troubling problems with how powerful it is today.
It seems that when you read The Meat Racket, you're not only reading about the poultry industry, you're not only reading about Tyson Foods, but you're reading about a conversation about free enterprise and profit and business, because Tyson was built on smarts, it was built on risk-taking, and it was built on acquisition and getting bigger. And that has been rewarded, but there have been people who, it seems, have also suffered because of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a paradox, and it's kind of hard to wrap your head around as a business reporter. The fact that, you know, free enterprise and competition and innovation led to the creation of Tyson Foods. And by and large, you know, nobody handed Don Tyson anything, although I would point out the company really benefited from federal subsidies of many kinds over the decades. But you know, the company was built through the kind of smarts you're talking about. But one of the paradoxes of competitive markets and capitalism is that firms can get so big that they pass this point whereby they actually gain really profound market power. And when companies gain enough power to affect markets, they can start to distort the laws of supply and demand. And then you start having problems with competition in the business. It's a trend we've seen play out again and again in American history. And that's why antitrust laws that kind of curb this and try to reinstitute competition. Well, shoot, antitrust laws have been around for centuries. And they were codified, you know, in the early 1900s, late 1800s for a reason. We realized you had to keep markets moving in a way that kept them competitive. And I think it's one of the great ironies of Tyson Foods and the handful of giant competitors that are left today, like Cargill and Smithfield and JBS, is that they were born in competitive markets, but when you look at the meat system today, it really is defined by centralization and command and control economics and not transparent markets or competition. Just a tiny example, I mean, Tyson Foods can control production on about 4,000 chicken farms from one office in Springdale. That's a centralized control system. It's not a bunch of independent entrepreneurs making independent decisions, the kind of give and take you think of for open markets.
At the end of your part of the book, you include a statement from Tyson because you had detailed questions for them when you were done with your part, and you wanted them to respond. And to some, they did respond, and you include that in the text of the book. But what they didn't respond to necessarily, specifically, you included in the statement from them. They suggest that you talk to a few disgruntled farmers who had bad experiences, which is what will happen in a competitive work environment, and that it's not representative.
Sure, and I just really disagreed with that assessment pretty strongly for a few reasons. And where do I start? I mean, first of all, I'll acknowledge some of the people I interviewed were disgruntled. And you know what? I'd be pretty disgruntled, too, if I had gone through what they went through. But you can hardly call Don Tyson, Haskell Jackson, and Jim Blair disgruntled former employees. I mean, these are the people that built the company. Their stories are represented in a full, fair way throughout the book. But, you know, if the farmers I interviewed who had a bad deal were outliers or, you know, bad apples in a big bunch, then I wouldn't have written the book. It is clear, and there's overwhelming evidence, these people are representative of the realities in the chicken business. And if people certainly shouldn't take my word for it, you can go online. There was a series of unprecedented workshops between the Department of Justice and Department of Agriculture. And they went on a listening tour around the country, and there's a huge body of documentary evidence that they left on the internet that shows systemic, industry-wide abuses of the kind I document in the book, and that I've been researching this for years. There are lawsuits around the country, case after case of this stuff happening. So they're representative cases, and you know, I think the National Chicken Council, or no, it was the American Meat Institute, they said Chris Leonard's only getting one side of the story. I mean, geez, you read the book, half of it is a history of Tyson Foods told by the people inside the company. It's not one side of the story.
Finally, I have to ask, you lived and worked in Northwest Arkansas for a while. You now live in Washington, D.C. After this book, you've been interviewed by NPR, MSNBC, others. Do you get a sense that people outside of Northwest Arkansas understand that you have one of the most influential food companies in the world? You have the world's largest retailer in this little, small area. Is there a sense, I guess I'm asking, in the business world, what is happening and the influences from Northwest Arkansas?
No. There's not, and it's unbelievable. You've got two of the most influential companies in the United States and arguably on planet Earth based in Northwest Arkansas, Tyson Foods and Walmart Stores. And the impact and scope of what they're doing is totally underappreciated by the national press, which unfortunately is increasingly isolated on the coasts because of the downturn in the journalism business, where they have cut reporters aggressively in the Midwest. And I think it's a deeply misunderstood story, undercovered, underappreciated. I think every national outlet that covers business has got to have a bureau in Northwest Arkansas. You understand Walmart, you understand modern retail. You understand Tyson Foods, you're understanding the modern food system. And these companies are giants. When they move, it makes ripples that affect everybody else. And it is just absolutely underreported and undercovered.
Christopher Leonard is the author of the new book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last month and is a former business reporter for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's Northwest Arkansas Bureau. He now lives in the Washington, D.C. area.